RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Time now for our Legal Hub. It's a Wednesday morning and it's great to have lawyer Sean Rush on RCR again. He joins us for, I don't think it's your first rodeo here, Sean, for Legal Hub anyway. Welcome.
Thanks, Paul. Yeah, well, I'm you know, you're usually here talking about coastal planning or things like that, but today I think we're going to talk about the announcement from the government about RMA reform.
That's right. So let's do a bit of history first, because I've got this this Town and Country Planning Act thing in my head. How many years ago is that now?
That actually ceased when the RMA replaced it, I believe. Before my time as a lawyer, I mean, I qualified in 1992, which is the first year the RMA was in effect. So there was a lot of, well, you know, scratching heads about what do we do. Firm I worked for, they did a lot of town planning stuff. In fact, one of my first jobs was to actually look at the RMA, because one of our clients wanted to open a pub, an English pub, ye old English pub in Havelock North, and had to provide a suitable car parks for X amount of people. But there was this requirement to go and consult with all the neighbours all up and down the street, and it just seemed a little bit bizarre. But nevertheless, that was from the RMA.
Was there anything wrong with the way it used to be done, really?
I confess I don't have any sort of expertise with what happened under the old regime, although all I can say is we never had these very partisan, you know, divisive sort of policies in the old days. But then again, in the old days, councillors never got paid, so you tended to get, you know, one sort of demographic of, you know, sort of wealthy people who have been successful wanting to give back, or else property speculators who wanted to steal, you know, local properties.
From the inside,
yeah. But it did seem to, by and large, work. The big change came, really, it wasn't in New Zealand, like a lot of these controversial things. It didn't come from New Zealand, but really came from, you know, an evolution of sustainability principles that firstly came out of Europe, I think, really, particularly in, you know, sort of left-wing thinking, think tanks, and into the United Nations. So the United Nations used to have one game in town, which was security, you know, not to, you know, a remit around making sure we don't get another World War II. And slowly that sort of, there was scope creep, and sure enough, 1970, we've got the first Earth Conference and the United Nations Environmental Programme. And that led to, you know, some of these more sustainability issues, some of which you can trace back to the sorts of things that Karl Marx was talking about. You know,
we all
recognise Marxism, you know, had, you know, understandable concerns about workers being exploited, but we, you know, we can all celebrate that these days by unchecked capitalists. But also what people don't often realise these days is that there was a concern about exploitation, unfettered exploitation of the environment, which was also a very strong point, which Lenin, you know, introduced in the Soviet Russia, and you know, it applied to metals and coal and resources. So, you know, you can see actually, you know, how extreme left thinking sort of now colours, you know, sort of the political landscape, and people have sort of like understood sustainability to be one of these, you know, it's a nice word, it's good, how can possibly be wrong? But actually, there is a school of thought that suggests that it's an anti-growth or a degrowth agenda, or else it's being used or manipulated in that space. So, you know, the RMA certainly did put more barriers in the way of getting things done. And so perhaps the balance, it was founded in this kind of sustainability thinking, was founded on the precautionary principle, which, you know, as a developer, you kind of have to sort of like ask everybody, you know, is this going to be okay? And if someone raises a concern, you kind of have to go and prove that concern is unfounded.
Or pay the money.
We don't need to. The use of the precautionary principle is not warranted because of good evidence to suggest otherwise. So,
yeah,
you know, what we're hearing now, you know, what we had under the RMA was a lot of fetters on property rights. You know, it started feeding into, I mean, the Parker reforms, which have now gone, but gave really extensive rights to iwi around the land development over areas. They were introducing the significant natural areas.
Yep.
When I was a city councillor, a lot of people got very upset because the council had identified, you know, native, you know, growth in your backyard, and that was going to be something you couldn't touch, so you couldn't put a, you know, a kid's playhouse there. So, you know, that sort of thinking has now been, is now looks like it's going to be swept away, led by Simon Court, who's the Undersecretary, with, you know, Chris Bishop, who's got a broader remit in the space. And what I really noticed, actually, which is signals a really big change, is that the guiding principle of the new legislation will be founded on property rights. So we'll need to wait and see exactly how extensive that features. But nevertheless, it says that if you are the owner of your property, the starting point is you'll be able to develop it in a manner that that you please. Now, that's a switch in emphasis from where we are at the moment.
Yeah, well, that's a natural thing, isn't it? I mean, your property is your property, and, okay, you can't build the most ugliest structure in the neighbourhood and devalue everything. But what do you think was in, again, sticking with a bit of history here, Geoffrey Palmer was the architect of the RMA, wasn't he? And we know what side of the political fence he was on at the time. What do you think was, what has the way the RMA has worked out, what do you think that said about the initial thinking? Do you think there was a lot of anticipated creep, or it was kind of known that this is how it would evolve anyway? What do you think about that?
My take on it, so, you know, Sir Geoffrey Palmer, senior member of the Labor Party, the sustainability principles came out of a report done by a Labor minister from Norway, Prime Minister, I think she was, Gro Brundtland. So to expect that these Labor parties don't sort of like caucus now and again and come up with common ideas is probably a bit naive. So I think, you know, Sir Geoffrey has set himself a number of objectives as a politician in the legal space with the Bill of Rights Act, which I think most people would agree is a good thing. I think this RMA reform is another thing. So, you know, of course, the other thing he's done with it was the treaty principles stuff.
Yeah. Well, the Bill of Rights Act didn't work out too well just in the last few years either.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it showed just how toothless it was, I suppose. So, you know, my thinking is that, you know, like a lot of things that come from overseas, overseas thinking that may not actually be really targeted at a little country like New Zealand that actually is pretty green, and most of us are all brought up, no matter what side of the political fence you're on, we're all brought up as environmentalists. We all love to swim at the beach and go fishing and, you know, go hunting and those sorts of things. You sort of wonder, well, maybe we should have maybe not looked abroad for to some of these places with, you know, mega cities and massive populations that, you know, have got real sustainability issues. And maybe we should have come up with something a little bit more customised. So, I mean, hopefully this new direction, Paul, I hope it doesn't, you know, it doesn't swing, you know, well from the left to well to the right, because that will just be a recipe for disaster. We all love our country, love our environment, but nevertheless, things we need to change. We can't build in the way that we used to. And, you know, there are barriers that are in the way, both at the local body sort of space, but also in national legislation. So I'm hopeful that we can come up with legislation that goes through a rigorous select committee process, you know, maintains that guiding principle of property rights, but puts in place appropriate safeguards, but nevertheless allows us to do the sort of development that we need to house people.
Is it fair to say that the RMA became weaponized in some way? Because it seems that it was used to support a enviro/political agenda for the sake of it, not for the sake of the actual, you know, physically what's happening, but to sort of impose a rule set and you know, the sustainability as a philosophical thing.
Yeah.
On people who actually own their properties. We've forgotten about that, and ownership means ownership.
What I'd say is that the fact that governments of both stripes have had to enact legislation like the fast track stuff. So the Labor people did the same thing, and the previous national government had the, you know, what they call the, it's called the SHA, something anyway, but it was fast track development. Just shows that actually there's clearly a big problem there. Mm. And I think you're right. I mean, the people with the right amount of money and the right amount of lawyers could frustrate things. And anyone who's, you know, involved in investment knows that, you know, you need to we all recognize that it takes some period of time to get your investment built. And after that, you start making a return. And if there's a delay in that, then the whole economics sort of blows out. And that's what the RMA was doing, providing opportunity, uncertainty for investors, because they weren't really that sure that they will be actually making the return they need to support the investment at the time that they would ordinarily expect to do so. And so they don't invest.
We've heard stories here of people having to pay ridiculous sums just to get quite minor things signed off. So again, there seemed to be a kind of industry associated with it, low-hanging money, let's say.
I think the new legislation is going to eliminate some of those opportunities. I think the framework will be more that if you are, you know, complying with what the legislation or regulations say, you don't need to. I think there'll be more. At the moment, there are, you know, discretionary consents and other types of consents. I think that's going to be simplified right down to a process that allows you to go forward at the same time with some confidence that you will not be held up by the process, but you might be doing the process in parallel.
Mm. The other thing is that it seems that, and we've seen this as a phenomenon, I know it's only a year in, but there was a change of government. It was all clear what was in coalition agreements. Yet they've been, you know, the train is sort of like rattled on as if nothing had changed. I guess it's hard to turn around the culture of a public service or a local body, officials and so on and so forth. That would have to catch, if there to be these reforms bedded in, that would have to change, wouldn't it? Do you think it can after all this time?
Yeah, I'm like you. I think it is a super tanker that's hard to turn around. The thinking is so embedded in the, you know, people like the chief city planners that it will be difficult. I just noticed a senior appointment at Wellington City Council checked, I won't say who it is, their CV, and sure enough, worked for Ministry for Environment. Sure enough, did some stuff with Waka Kotahi, and you kind of just go, oh, okay, so it's just more of the same. And, you know, I think personally crying up some private sector expertise, but I do agree. But nevertheless, councils do respond to legislation, and legislation that tells them that you've got to work within the space, you know, can be used if the councils aren't playing ball. So I think, you know, we do need to make a start. And, you know, as I say, the opportunity really is through the select committee process where we can try and find the right balance that people feel that actually we can give this a try rather than some other areas that we are seeing at the moment where the other side are just saying, well, when are you going to let you try this? And the media are jumping on board. So, yeah, I mean, hopefully that's not the case here. We know that both Labor and National have been talking a big game about RMA reform for years. The Labor guys, I think, went a little bit AWOL with what they wanted to do. No one seemed to want it. Yeah, people like from the Wind Farm Association saying this will kill wind farms. And like, you just can't go, well, surely we want wind farms, even though they're not really supported unless the government funds them. So, yeah, anyway, let's hope that we can have a sensible conversation. I mean, I haven't heard any hysterical shrieking to date, but, you know, when you talk with politically savvy people about property rights, they know that that's a calling sign for Republican Party people in the USA.
Yeah.
But it doesn't need to be here in New Zealand.
Are we on, and we've talked about this before, you're in just north of Kapiti Coast, you know, sea level rise, there's all the use of the worst scenario data for, you know, climate future, the computer modelling, you know, that's affecting potentially insurance and mortgages and all sorts of things. Is there an inevitable collision course with private property rights, let's say more focused in whatever replaces the RMA, and then all of that happening? Because you said that, you know, local government follows laws. And I've been to some of those meetings and heard the local government people speak, and they're like, they're right in it. They're all in for that. So is there a collision course there, or is that something that would have to be figured out in these select committees before the final laws are put in place?
It's a really good point, actually, that the manager retreat sort of philosophy, again, another one that's come from abroad, right? So whenever you see these buzzwords also being talked about in Australia and Canada, you know that it's come from somewhere, not in your own country. And so I immediately get suspicious. So you look at manager retreat and it's telling people that the government will tell you when you can't, when you should not live in your house anymore, and the government will tell you how much it might give you as some sort of compensation package to move, despite the fact that people are very, you know, competent to make their own decisions depending on, you know, their own appetite and, you know, their own well-being and their own sort of economic circumstances. So I do think that there will be an inevitable collision between those proponents of managed retreat under the last government, which seemed to be totally unfunded anyway, and this new direction whereby I would expect that those residents and businesses that are, you know, wanting to move away because they're sick of being inundated will be able to do so and sell. Now, of course, there's the big elephant there is if the sewage system packs up because it's not being able to drain. Usually it's the stormwater system, right? Actually, stormwater can be managed through pumps, so it's not really something that has to be addressed in a policy relevant period, if you know, I'd say 30 to 50 years. You know, I think there's still a lot more time, and, you know, the evidence that we're seeing, certainly on Kapiti anyway, is again, we see this trend of accretion of the currents depositing landmass in the way of the sea. And actually, we're just getting safer and safer. So, I mean, there's a couple of places that are, you know, subject to erosion, but there's been no real incidents of coastal inundation of the sea, you know, and there could be a tsunami any day, we know that, and but that'll be a one-off and no one's going to move away because there's been a tsunami. So I do think that the shift towards property rights should alleviate some of the concerns that folks have, but it will need to come with a package which says that councils that want to warn prospective buyers of sea level rise in a particular area will need to use a proper climate model that actually reflects a bit more reality than necessarily an extreme one, which has been labelled even by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change as unlikely or low likelihood. So,
yeah,
you know, and that will then...
I mean, is there any modelling that's actually realistic, Sean? You know, because you know about this area as well and what you've been working and studying for many years. Is there an accurate way of... Here's a question, of modelling anything, really?
You know, Paul, the modelling that I've seen for sea level rise on the Kapiti Coast has, after 15 years, was shown to be 550% inflated.
Wow.
You know, so that's a model that, I mean, that's a theory of science that has now been proved to be wrong. And Richard Feynman, who is a famous physicist.
Yeah, I'm a fan of his.
Yeah, I mean, he just set out that, basically said that if it fails that test, you need to start again. So I don't know why we don't seem to listen to the likes of Feynman anymore. The modelling that if I was to put together a model in, say, 1990 about Wellington sea level rise, and I had simply used the previous 30 years and expanded that through to from 1990 to 2020, I'd be about bang on.
Yeah, yeah.
So why wouldn't you just do that again? Well, the thing is because we're being told that the climate's changing, that everyone's getting warmer, and we're lots more melting and so on. But the IPCC quietly, in Chapter 12, I think it is, have set out a statement saying that they don't expect to see the anthropogenic signal until at least 2050. So it's, you know, I just think that there's an awful lot of drama, which is some of which is underpinned by some good science, others underpinned by unlikely models, and even more underpinned by media running off. I recently had an exchange with the Media Council about a piece around the Atlantic Meridional Oscillation and it being slowing down and we're all going to freeze soon.
Oh, soon.
And when I looked at the paper said, well, according to our model, this could start in 1750 years.
Oh, gosh, get ready.
And I complained to the Media Council and they came back and said, oh, we think it's okay because that is soon in geological time.
Oh, gosh, really? Yeah.
So that's another thing the government could do is actually do a little bit more than have this Media Council who look at each other. One person on it went, you know, he's got a really good point. People shouldn't be expected to actually go into the actual paper and find out for themselves when they're reading a newspaper. Anyway, so just a little bit of insult there.
So, well, once this is done and dusted, let's say it will be, and the RMA sort of disappears off into the rear view mirror, what do you think people will make of it historically?
I think, like most legislation that's not really worked, it'll be fast forgotten. Let's not forget that these are tools for property developers and planners, and they will very quickly seize upon the new tools and will say goodbye to the RMA, but won't be for long. They will already be looking at what's been cooked up in the beehive in this space, and from day one, as it was for the RMA, from day one, they'll be ready. The law firms will be out doing their briefings and trying to market their expertise with the new legislation. And I think we'll find out very quickly whether whether they've got it right or whether it's an improvement. I think it will be an improvement, but nevertheless, history will. I think the history will judge the RMA as an experiment on legislation, on processes, and on influences that came from a part of the world that is not reflective of New Zealand.
And the two bills separates what the functions, the blobby functions of the RMA into two distinct areas, what urban and environmental. I guess it's obvious why that would be.
I don't know how those separations are going to happen and where the overlaps might be. But nevertheless, it's suggesting that if you are in an urban area, you will be able to do things pretty quickly and rapidly with very little concern if you are the owner of property. And the environmental overlay will likely deal with, you know, true environment and less so where we are in the urban centres.
Some are not going to like it. I wonder if we're going to see people glued to motorways and chained to railings as they kind of process.
Well, it's one way to spend a morning. As Greenpeace had a meeting with the Strateria folks, a very positive, warm meeting. So the Strateria folks, and I'm in the same building with them, you see. And at the end of the meeting, they sprinted off down the stairs to the front door, chained themselves to it. And next thing you know, there's someone outside my window holding up a sign. On reflection, I should have, you know, captured them for an hour and a half and given them a lesson on climate change. I did say to them, look, I've got a master's in climate change and I've got an IPCC expert reviewer. I know more about climate change than all of you guys put together. I should have actually sat them down because they were sat down. They couldn't go anywhere and given them chapter and verse. That's what I should have done.
You missed your opportunity, Sean.
Yeah, I know. Crazy.
Missed your opportunity.
But, you know, people will do that, you know, and the way that people are protesting these days is more extreme than ever. That it used to be, you know, you want to show your policymakers that there's a lot of people that are against whatever it is that you're protesting for. These days, though, it's not just that, but you want to upset as many people as you can in order to draw attention to yourself, get some free publicity. And I just think that, you know, maybe that's another area of reform we can look at.
Makes me laugh. So,
Costs us thousands, right? So, you know, it cost me a morning's work. I had a go at them and I said, you know, I've got a family, I've got clients I'm servicing, I'm trying to do a good things. I'm bringing new guests on stream in Taranaki as part of one of my clients.
Yep.
You know, and you guys think that your worldview is better than mine. And I was pretty angry, actually. I had to calm down. But, you know, it's simply not fair. And, you know, Greenpeace will be hearing from me.
Okay. It makes me laugh, though. They turn up, they do a protest, and the first guy they see is an expert on climate.
Yeah.
Whoops. We didn't see that one coming. Damn.
Not their type of expert, though, right?
No, of course not.
I'm just
wrong expert.
Too measured, but I'm also expert on energy. Yeah. And they said, oh, are you in favour of new coal mines? And I said, well, we need energy, affordable energy, so that our kids can thrive, be educated properly, our parents can have that pension they deserve. But, you know, if we end up poor, then no one wins.
Yeah.
And equity, inequality actually just gets bigger and bigger.
Yeah, forget that. All right, that was really interesting, Sean.
Cool. Thanks,
Thank you for that. Thank you for coming on our Legal Hub. Oh, and how long do you think this will take to work its way through the process? You might not know, but what's usually the average for that?
Oh, I think they want to have a first draft by the end of the year.
Okay, all right.
Yeah. Did I read that somewhere?
Okay. Well, we can update if we find that that's not quite right.
Well, they're putting together an expert advisory panel to develop it through to the end of the year.
Okay. Well, they want to be campaigning on something like that, wouldn't they? And that's 2025, isn't it? Or 26, sorry. Yeah.
Well, I think they'd like to get it in before then.
Yeah. All right, Sean Rush, lawyer, climate expert, and protester pacifier.
Cheers, Paul.
Yeah, and we'll talk again soon. Thanks for coming on our Legal Hub, Sean. See ya.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.